Slowly.
As the boy followed this direction, Binnebik spouted another rush of words in the unfamiliar language, waving his hands imploringly at the unblinking Scythi.
What? Where are the others?
Simon whispered. But Binnebik silenced him again, this time with a small but violent headshake.
No time is there. No time. For your life, we are fighting.
The Trall raised his own hands in the air, and Simon, having dropped the bow, did the same, turning his palms outward.
You have not, I am hoping, lost the white arrow.
I don't know.
Daughter of the mountains, I must hope not. Slowly drop your quiver. There.
He sputtered out a little bit more of what Simon took to be Scythi tongue, then kicked at the quiver so that the arrows scattered across the broken snow like dark jackstraws, all but one. Only its triangular tip, pearl blue like a liquid drop of sky, stood out against the surrounding whiteness.
Oh, praise to the high places, Binnebik sighed. Staja, Ame Ina,
he called to the Scythi, who watched like cats whose avian quarry has chosen to turn and sing instead of fly away.
The white arrow! You cannot be in ignorance of this. Mshesti keoso diana olingit.
This is rare,
the Scyther with the bow said, lowering it slightly. His accent was odd, but his command of the Western speech very good. He blinked.
To be taught the rules of song by a Trall.
His cold smile returned briefly.
You may spare us your exhortations and your crude translations. Pick up your arrow and bring it here to me.
He hissed a few words to the other two as Binnebik bent to the quiver. They looked back once more at Simon and the Trall, then dashed up the hill with startling speed, seeming to barely dimple the snow as they went, so quick and light were their steps. The one remaining behind kept his arrow trained in Simon's general direction as Binnebik went trudging forward.
Hand it toward me, the Scyther directed. Feathers first, Trall. Now, step back toward your companion.
He eased up on the bow to examine the slender white object, allowing the arrow to slide forward until the string was almost slack, and he could hold the nocked arrow and bow stave in one hand. Simon was aware for the first time of the shallow rasp of his own rapid breathing. He lowered his shaking hands a bit as Binnebik crunched to halt nearby.
It was given to this young man for a service he was rendering,
Binnebik said defiantly. The Scyther looked up at him and cocked a slanting eyebrow. He seemed at Simon's first glance, much like the first one of his kindred Simon had seen. The same high-boned cheeks and strange, bird-like movements. He was dressed in pants and jacket of shimmery white cloth, dotted at shoulders, sleeves, and waist, with slender dark green scales. His hair, almost black, but also with a strange greenish tinge, he wore in two complicated braids, one falling before each ear. Boots, belt, and quiver were of soft, milk-hued leather. Simon realized that it was only the Scyther's position upslope and silhouetted against the drab sky that allowed him to be clearly seen. If the Fair One were to stand against the snow in a copse of trees, he would be as invisible as the wind.
Issi, ye,
the Scyther muttered feelingly, and turned to hold the arrow to the shrouded sun. Lowering it, he stared wonderingly at Simon for a moment, then narrowed his eyes.
Where did you find this, Sodoroya?
He asked harshly.
How did one such as you come by such a thing?
It was given to me,
Simon said, color coming back into his cheeks and strength to his voice. He knew what he knew.
I saved one of your people. He shot it at a tree, then ran away.
The Scyther again looked him over carefully, and seemed about to say something more. Instead, he turned his attention up the hillside. A bird whistled a long, complex call, or so Simon thought at first, until he saw the small movements of the white-clad Scyther's lips. He waited, still as a statue, until there came an answering trill.
Go now, before me,
he said, swinging around to gesture with his bow at the Trall and boy. They walked with difficulty up the steep slope, their captor moving lightly behind them, slowly turning the white arrow over and over in his slender fingers. Within the space of a few hundred heartbeats, they reached the rounded top of the knoll and started down the other side. There, four Scythi crouched around a tree-rimmed, snow-blanketed gully. The two Simon had already seen, recognizable only by the bluish tint to their braided hair, and another pair whose tresses were smoky grey, although like the others, their golden faces were unwrinkled. At the gully's bottom, beneath the menacing quadrangle of Scythi arrows, sat Hasten, Grimrick, and Sludig. They were each one blooded, and wore the hopelessly defiant expressions of cornered animals.
"Bones of St. Eostin," Hasten swore when he saw the new arrivals. "Ah, God, boy, was hoping you got away." He shook his head. "Still, better than being a dead un, I suppose."
"Do you see, Troll?" Sludig said bitterly, his bearded face smeared with red. "Do you see what we have called on ourselves? Demons? We should never have mocked that dark one."
The Scyther who held the arrow, seemingly the leader, said a few words in his language to the others and gestured for Simon's companions to climb from the pit.
"Demons, they are not,"
Binnebik said as he and Simon braced their legs to help the others scramble up. A difficult task on the shifting snow.
"They are Scythi, and they will do us no harm. It is, after all is said, their own white arrow that is compelling them."
The Scythi's leader gave the troll a sour look, but said nothing. Grimrick came gasping up onto level ground.
Scythi?
He said, struggling for breath. A cut just below his scalp had painted his forehead with a solid swath of crimson.
"Now we've gone walking into old, old stories, and that's sure. Scythi folk, may Osiris the Aiden protect us all."
He made the sign of the tree, and wearily turned to help the staggering Sludig.
"What happened?" Simon asked. "How did you... What happened to..."
"The ones who pursued us are dead," Sludig said, sagging back against a tree trunk.
His burnie was slashed in several places, and his helmet, which dangled from his hand, was scraped and dented like an old pot.
"We did for some ourselves. The rest,"
he flapped a limp hand at the Scythi guards,
"fell with bodies full of arrows."
"They'd shot us too, sure, if the troll hadn't spoken in their tongue,"
Hasten said. He smiled faintly at Binnebik.
"We didn't think bad of you when you ran. Praying for you, we were."
"I went for finding Simon. He is my charge," Binnebik said simply.
"But..."
Simon looked around, hoping against hope, but saw no other prisoner.
Then that was Ethelben who fell. Before we reached the first hill?"
Hasten nodded slowly.
"'Twas."
"Damn their souls," Grimrick swore. "There were Rimmer's men, those murdering bastards."
"Scarless," Sludig said, eyes hard. The Scythi began making gestures for them to get up.
"Two of them wore the Coldskriker Raven," he continued, rising. "Oh, how I am praying to catch him with nothing between us but our axes."
"You are waiting with a host of many others,"
Binnebik said.
"Wait," Simon said, feeling terribly hollow. This was not right. He turned to the leader of the Scythi company. "You have been looking at my arrow. You know my story is true. You cannot take us anywhere or do anything until we see what has happened to our companion."
The Scyther looked at him appraisingly.
"I do not know your story is true, man-child, but we will find out soon enough. Sooner than you might wish. As to the other..."
He took a moment to survey Simon's ragged party.
"Very well. We shall allow you to see to your other man."
He spoke to his comrades and they followed the men down the hill. The quiet company passed the arrow-plumed corpses of two of their attackers, eyes wide and mouths agape. Snow was already sifting back over their still forms, covering the scarlet stains. They found Ethelban 100 ells from the lake road. The broken shaft of an ashwood arrow stood out from the side of his neck below his beard, and his splayed, twisted posture told that his horse had rolled over him in its death throes.
It wasn't a long a dying, Hasten said, tears standing in his eyes. Aiden be praised, 'twas quick.
They dug a hole for him as best they could, hacking at the hard ground with swords and axes. The Scythi stood by, unconcerned as geese. The companions wrapped Ethelben in his thick cloak and lowered him into the shallow grave. When he was covered over, Simon pushed the dead man's sword into the earth as a marker.
Take his helmet, Hasten said to Sludig,
and Grimrick nodded.
It not wants it to go unused, the other Erkinlander agreed.
Sludig hung his own ruined helm on the pommel of Ethelben's sword before taking the one held out to him.
We will avenge you, man, the Rimmer's Guarder said. Blood for blood.
Silence settled over them. Snow filtered down through the trees as they stood regarding the patch of naked ground. Soon, it would all be white again.
Come, the Scythe chief said at last. We have waited for you long enough. There is someone who will want to see this arrow.
Simon was last to move.
I scarcely had time to know you, Ethelben, he thought. But you had a good loud laugh. I will remember that.
They turned and headed back into the cold hills. The spider hung motionless, like a dull brown gem in an intricate necklace. The web was complete now, the last strands laid delicately in place. It stretched from one side of the ceiling corner to the other, quivering gently in the rising air, as though strummed by invisible hands. For a moment, Iskrimnor lost the thread of talk, important talk though it was. His eyes had drifted from the worried faces huddled near the fireplace in the great hall, roving up to the darkened corner and to the tiny builder at rest.
There's sense, he told himself. You build something and then you stay there. That's the way it's meant to be. Not this running here, running there. Never see your blood family or your home roofs for a year at a time.
He thought of his wife, sharp-eyed, red-cheeked Gudrun. She had not offered him a solitary word of rebuke, but he knew it angered her that he had been gone so long from Elvrit's Harla, that he had left their oldest son, the pride of her heart, to rule a great duchy. And to fail. Not that Isorn, or anyone else in Rimmer's Guard, could have stopped Skarli and his followers. Not with the High King behind him. Still, it had been young Isorn who had been master while his father was gone, and it was Isorn who would be remembered as the one who had seen the Kaldskryker clan, traditional enemies of the Elbrits Hallamen, strut into the Longhouse as masters.
And I was looking forward to coming home this time, the old Duke thought sadly. It would have been nice to tend to my horses and cows, and settle a few local disputes and watch my children raise their own children. Instead, all the land is being torn up again like leaky thatch. God save me. I had enough of fighting when I was younger, for all my talk.
Fighting was, after all, mostly for young men, whose grip on life was light and careless, and to give the old men something to talk about, to remember when they sat warm in their halls, with winter moaning outside.
A damned old dog like me is just about ready to lie down and sleep by the fire.
He plucked at his beard and watched the spider scramble toward the darkened roof corner, where an unwary fly had made an unexpected stop.
We thought John had forged a peace that would last 1,000 years. Instead, it has not survived his death by 2 summers. You build, and you build some more, laying strand over strand like that little fellow up there, only to have a wind come along and blow everything to pieces.
And so I have near crippled 2 horses to bring these tidings, as fast as I could, Lord,
the young man finished, as Iskrimnor turned his ear back to the urgent discussion.
You have done magnificently, Deornoth, Joshua said. Please, rise.
His face still damp from his ride, the lank-haired soldier stood, wrapping himself more tightly in the thick blanket the prince had given him. He looked much as he had that other time, when garbed in the costume of the holy monk for the St. Tunath's Day festivities, he had brought the prince news of his father's death. The prince laid his hand upon Deonoth's shoulder.
I'm glad to have you back. I feared for your safety, and cursed myself for having to send you on such a dangerous errand.
He turned to the others.
So, you have heard Deonoth's report. Elias has at last gone into the field. He is bound for Naglamund with...
Deonoth,
you said... Some 1,000 knights and more, and near 10,000 foot,
the soldier said unhappily.
That averages the different reports in a way that seems most reliable.
I'm sure, Joshua waved his hand,
and we have perhaps a fortnight at most, until he is at our walls. I should think so, sire,
Deonoth nodded.
And what of my master?
De Vercellis asked.
Well, Baron, the soldier began, then clenched his teeth until a fit of shivering had passed. Nad Mullach was in a mad uproar, understandably, of course, with what is happening to the West.
He broke off to look over to Prince Gwythyn, who sat a short way off from the rest, staring miserably at the ceiling.
Go on, said Joshua calmly. We will hear it all.
Deonoth turned his gaze away from the Hernesteer man.
So, as I said, good information was hard to come by. However, according to several of the rivermen up from Abingat on the coast, your Duke Leobardis has set sail from Naban, and is even now on the high seas, probably to make landfall near Cranhir.
With how many men?
Iskrimnor rumbled. Deonoth shrugged.
Different people say different things. 300 horse, perhaps, 2,000 or so foot.
That sounds correct, Prince Joshua, De Vercellis said, lips pursed contemplatively. Many of the liege lords doubtless would not go along, frightened as they are of crossing the High King. And the Perdruinese will stay neutral, as they usually do. Count Strehawi knows he will do better helping both sides and saving his ships to haul goods. So we may hope for Leobardis' strong help, although I might have wished it stronger still.
Joshua looked around the circle of men.
Even if these Nabonae should beat Elias to the gate,
Baron Ordmayer said, fear poorly hidden on his plump features.
Still, Elias will have 3 times our numbers.
But we have the walls, sir,
Joshua replied, his narrow face stern.
We are in a strong, strong place.
He turned back to Deonoth, and his expression softened. Give us the last of your news, my faithful friend, and then you must sleep. I fear for your health, and I will need you strong in the days ahead. Deonoth mustered a faint smile.
Yes, sire. The tidings that are left are not happy ones either, I fear. The Hernesteri have been driven from the field at Inniscrick.
He started to glance at the place where Gwythyn sat, but instead dropped his eyes.
They say King Luth has been wounded, and his armies have fallen back into the Greenspoke Mountains, the better to Harry Scarley and his men.
Joshua looked gravely over to the Hernesteri prince.
So, it is at least better than you feared, Gwythyn. Your father yet lives and continues the fight.
The young man turned. His eyes were red.
Yes, they continue the fight, while I sit here, inside stone walls, drinking ale and eating bread and cheese like a fat townsman. My father may be dying. How can I stay here?
And do you think you can beat Scarley with your 500 men, lad?
Iskrimnor asked, not unkindly.
Or would you seek a quick, glorious death, rather than wait to see what is the best policy?
I am not so foolish as that, Gwythyn replied coldly. And, Bagbus heard Iskrimnor, who are you to be saying such to me? What of that foot of steel you are saving for Scarly's guts?
Different, Iskrimnor muttered, embarrassed. I did not speak of storming Elric's Hollow with my 12 knights.
And all I mean to do is steal around the flank of Scarley's ravens, and go to my people in the mountains.
Unable to meet Prince Gwythyn's bright, demanding stare, Iskrimnor let his eyes slide back up to the roof corner. where the brown spider was industriously wrapping something in clinging silk.
Gwythyn, Joshua said soothingly, I ask only that you wait until we can speak more. One or two days will make little difference.
The young Hernesteeman stood up, his chair scraping against the stone flags.
Wait? That is all that you do is wait, Joshua. Wait for the local muster. Wait for Leobardus and his army. Wait for Elias to climb the walls and put Nagliman to the torch. I am tired of waiting.
He raised an unsteady hand to forestall Joshua's protests. Do not forget, Joshua, I am a prince too. I came to you out of the friendship of our fathers, and now my father is wounded and harried by northern devils. If he dies unsuccored and I am become king, will you order me then? Will you still think to hold me back? Brynjach, I cannot understand such craven reluctance.
Before he reached the door, he turned. I will tell my men to prepare for our departure tomorrow at sunset. If you think of some reason why I should not go, one that has escaped me, you know where I may be found.
As the prince flung the door shut behind him, Joshua rose to his feet.
I think there are many here who...
He paused and shook his head wearily. Who feel the need of some food and drink, you not least, Deonoth. But I ask you to remain a short moment while these others go ahead, so I may ask you of some private matters.
He waved Deveselis and the rest off to the dining hall, and watched them shuffle out, talking quietly among themselves.
Escrimno, he called, and the duke stopped in the doorway to look back inquiringly. You stay also, please.
When Escrimnor had settled himself in a chair again, Joshua looked expectantly to Deonoth.
And have you other news for me? The prince asked.
The soldier frowned.
If I had aught else of good tiding, my prince, I would have told you first, before the others arrived. I could find no trace of your niece, or the monk who accompanies her, but for one peasant farmer near the Greenwade Fork, who saw a pair of their description fording the river there some days ago, heading south.
Which is no more than what we knew they would do, as the Lady Vorsheva told us. But by now they are well into the Inniscrick, and the Blessed Osiris alone knows what may happen or where they will go next. Our only luck is that I am sure my brother Elias will march his army up the skirt of the hills, since in this wet season the Wealdhelm Road is the only safe place for the heavy wagons.
He stared at the wavering flames of the fire.
Well then, he said at last, my thanks to Yawnoth. If all my liegemen were such as you, then I could laugh at the High King's threat. The men are a good lot, sire, the young knight said loyally.
Go on now.
The prince extended his hand to pat Deonoth's knee.
Get some food and then some sleep. You will not be needed for duty until tomorrow.
Yes, sire.
The young Erkinlander threw off his blanket and stood, his back straight as a gatepost as he walked from the room. After he was gone, Joshua and Escrimnor sat in silence.
Miriamel gone God knows where, and Leobardus racing Elias to our gates.
The prince shook his head and kneaded his temples with his hand.
Luth wounded, the Hernesteri in retreat, and Elias Tool Scarly, master from the Vestiveg to the Grianspog. And atop all else, demons out of legend, walking the mortal earth.
He showed the Duke a grim smile.
The net grows tighter, uncle.
Escrimnor tangled his fingers in his beard.
The web is swaying in the wind, Joshua. A strong wind.
He left the remark unexplained, and silence crept back into the high hall. The man in the hound mask cursed weakly and spat another gobbet of blood onto the snow. Any lesser man he knew would now be dead, lying in the snow with his legs crushed and his ribs collapsed. But the thought was only faintly gratifying. All the years of ritual training and hardening toil that had saved his life when the dying horse rolled over him would be for naught unless he could reach somewhere sheltered and dry. Another hour or two of exposure would finish the work his dying steed had begun. The damnable Scythi, and their unexpected involvement, was nothing short of astonishing, had led their human captives within a few feet of where he had lain hidden, buried under a half foot of snow. He had summoned all his reserves of strength and courage to stay preternaturally still, while the fair folk had scanned the area. They must have concluded he had crawled away somewhere to die, which, of course, he had hoped they would, and a few moments later they had continued on their way. Now he huddled shivering where he had dug out from beneath the obscuring white blanket, summoning his strength for the next move. His only hope was to somehow get back to Hathstead, where a pair of his own men should now be waiting. He damned himself 100 times, forever trusting those louts of Scarlys, drunken pillagers and woman-beaters that they were, unfit to polish his boots. If only he had not been forced to send his own off on another mission. He shook his head in an attempt to clear it of the swirling, jiggling specks of light that floated against the gradually darkening sky, then pursed his cracked lips. The hoot of a snow owl issued incongruously from the snarling hound muzzle. While he waited, he tried once more, impossibly to stand, even to crawl. It was no use. Something was gravely wrong with both legs. Ignoring the scalding pain from his cracked ribs, he used his hands to drag himself a little farther toward the trees, then had to stop, laid flat out and panting. A moment later, he felt hot wind and lifted his head. The black muzzle of his helmet was doubled, as though in some queer mirror, by a grinning white snout only inches away. "Nikwa," he gasped, in a language quite unlike his native black Rimmerspack.
"Come here. Oh, then damn you, come."
The great hound took another step closer, until he loomed over his injured master.
"Now, hold,"
the man said, reaching up strong hands to clasp the white leather collar.
"And pull."
A moment later, he groaned in agony as the dog did pull, but he hung on, teeth clenched and eyes bulging behind the unchanging canine features of the helmet. The hammering, tearing pain almost pushed him over into insensibility as the hound drew him bumping across the snow, but he did not relax his grip until he reached the cover of the trees. Only then did he at last let go, let everything go. He slid down into darkness and brief surcease to pain. When he awoke, the grey of the sky had gone several shades darker, and the wind had swept a powdery layer of snow across him like a blanket. The great hound Nikwa still waited, unconcerned and unshivering despite his short fur, as though lounging before a blazing hearth. The man on the ground was not surprised. He well knew the icy black kennels of Sturmaspeik and knew how these beasts were raised. Looking at Nikwa's red mouth and curving teeth, and the tiny white eyes like drops of some milky poison, he was again grateful that it was he who followed the hounds, and not the other way around. He pulled off the helmet, not without effort since the fall had changed its shape, and pitched it into the snow at his side. With his knife, he cut his black cloak into long strips. Soon after, he began laboriously sawing down some of the slenderest young trees. It was horrible work on his agonized ribs, but he did his best to ignore the flashing pain and go on. He had 2 excellent reasons to survive. His duty to tell his masters of the unexpected attack by the Scythi, and his own heightened desire for revenge on this ragtag lot who had thwarted him 2 many times. The moon's blue-white eye was peering curiously through the treetops when he at last finished cutting. He used the strips of his cloak to bind a number of the shorter staves tightly to each leg as splints. Then, sitting with his legs stiffly before him, like a child playing noughts and crosses in the dirt, he bound short cross-pieces to the tops of the 2 long staves remaining. Clutching them carefully, he grabbed again at Nikwa's collar, letting the long corpse-white dog drag him up onto his feet, where he swayed precariously, until he could get the new-made crutches under his arms. He took a few steps, swiveling awkwardly on his unbending legs. It would do well enough, he decided, wincing at the sickening pain. Not that he had any choice. He looked at the snarling-mouthed helmet lying in the snow, thinking of the effort it would take to reach it, and the now useless weight of the thing. Then he leaned down, gasping, and picked it up anyway. It had been given him in the sacred caverns of Sturmaspake, by herself, when she named him her sacred hunter, he, a mortal. He could no more leave it lying in the snow than he could leave his own beating heart. He remembered that impossible, heady moment, the blue lights flickering in the chamber of the breathing harp, when he had knelt before the throne, before the serene shimmer of her silver mask. His excruciating pain lulled for a moment by the whine of memory, Nikwa silently padding at his heels. Ingen Jega moved haltingly down the long, tree-covered hill and began to think carefully about revenge. Simon and his companions, now lessened by one, did not have much stomach for talk, nor did their captors encourage any. They trudged silently and slowly through the snow-carpeted foothills as grey afternoon edged into evening. Somehow the Scythi seemed to know exactly where they wanted to go, although to Simon the pine-spotted slopes were featureless, one spot indistinguishable from another. The leader's amber eyes were always moving in his mask-like face, but he never seemed to be searching for anything. Rather, he gave the impression that he read the subtle language of the terrain as knowledgeably as Father Strangyard surveyed his bookshelves. The only time the Scyther leader displayed any reaction was early in their march, when Kantaka came trotting down an incline and fell in at Binnabik's side, nose twitching as she sniffed his hand, tail nervously tucked. The Scyther raised a half-curious eyebrow, then looked around to catch the glances of his fellows, whose narrow eyes had narrowed further. He made no sign that Simon could distinguish, but the wolf was allowed to pace along unhindered. Daylight was fading when the strange walking party turned north at last, and within a short time they were slowly circling the base of a steep slope whose snowy flanks were studded with jutting naked stone. Simon, shock and numbness worn off enough to make him all too aware of his achingly cold feet, gave silent thanks as the chief of their captors waved them to a halt. "Here," he said, gesturing to a large outcropping that thrust up high above their heads. "At the bottom," he pointed again, this time to a wide, waist-high fissure in the face of the stone. Before any of them could say a word, two of the Scythi guards slipped nimbly past them and slid themselves headfirst into the opening. In a moment they had vanished.
"Yo," he said to Simon. "Go after!"
There were angry mutters from Haston and the other two soldiers, but Simon, despite his unusual situation, felt strangely confident. Kneeling, he poked his head through the opening. It was a slender, shining tunnel, an ice-lined tube that twisted steeply up and away from him, seemingly hollowed from the very stone of the mountain. He decided that the Scyther who had gone before him must have climbed up beyond the next bend. There was no sign of them, and no one could hide in this glass-smooth, narrow passage, barely wide enough to allow him to raise his arms. He ducked back out into the chill open air. "How can I go through it? It's almost straight up, and it's covered in ice. I'll just slide back down."
"Look above your head," the chief Scyther replied. "You will understand."
Simon re-entered the tunnel, pushing in a little farther, so that his shoulders and upper body were inside too, and he could turn on his back to look up. The ice of the tunnel ceiling, if one could call something half an arm's length away a ceiling, was scored with a regular series of horizontal cuts that extended the visible length of the passage. Each was a few inches deep and wide enough to hold both hands comfortably side by side. He realized after some thought that he was intended to pull himself up with his hands and feet, bracing his back against the floor of the tunnel. Viewing the prospect with some dismay, since he had no idea how long the tunnel might be or what else might conceivably be sharing it with him, he considered backing out of the narrow passageway once more. After a moment, he changed his mind. The Scythi had shinned up before him as quickly as squirrels, and for some reason, He felt the urge to show them that if not as nimble as they, he was still bold enough to follow without coaxing. The climb was difficult, but not impossibly so. The tunnel turned often enough that he could make frequent stops to rest, bracing his feet against the bends in the passage. As he slowly grabbed, pulled, and braced, time after muscle-cramping time, the advantage of such an entrance tunnel, if this was, as it seemed, an entrance, became obvious. It was difficult going to clamber up and would be near impossible for any animal but a two-legged one. Anyone who needed to get out could slide down it as swiftly as a snake. He was just considering stopping for another rest when he heard voices speaking the liquid Scythi language just beyond his head. A moment later, strong hands reached down, grasping him by the harness straps of his chainmail and pulling him upward. He popped out of the tunnel with a gasp of surprise and tumbled onto a warm stone floor, puddled with snowmelt. The two Scythi who had dragged him out crouched by the passage mouth, faces obscure in the near darkness. The only light in the room, which was not really a room so much as a rock cavern, carefully swept clean of debris, came from a door-sized crevice in the opposite wall. Through this gap spilled a yellow gleam, painting a bright swath on the cavern floor. As Simon pulled himself to his knees, he felt a slender, restraining hand laid on his shoulder. The dark head sitter beside him pointed up at the low ceiling, then made a waving motion and gestured at the tunnel mouth.
"Wait," he said calmly, his speech not as fluent as his leader's. "We must wait."
Haston was next up, grumbling and cursing. The two Scythi had to worry his bulky form out of the opening like a cork from a wine jug. Binnabik appeared on his heels. The nimble troll had easily caught up with the Erkinlander, followed within a short while by Sludig and Grimrik. The three remaining Scythi clambered lively up behind them. No sooner had the last of the Fair Ones issued from the tunnel than the party went forward again, passing through the rock doorway and into a short passage beyond where they could at last stand upright. Lamps of some kind of milky golden crystal or glass had been set into niches in the wall, and their flickering light was enough to mask the glow of the door at the far end until they were almost upon it. One of the Scythi stepped to this gap in the stone, which, unlike the last, was shrouded with a hanging of dark cloth, and called out. An instant later, two more of their kindred pushed past the cloth. Each of them held a short sword made of what looked to be some dark metal. They stood silently alert, betraying no surprise or curiosity, as the leader of the captors spoke.
"We will bind your hands."
As he said this, the other Scythi produced coiled lengths of shiny black cord from beneath their clothing. Sludig stepped back a pace, bumping into one of the guards, who made a quiet hissing noise but offered no violence.
"No," the Rimmersman said, his voice dangerously tight. "I will not let them. No man will bind me against my will." "Nor me," Haston said.
"Don't be foolish," Simon said, and stepped forward, offering his own crossed wrists. "We will probably get out of this with our skins, but not if you start a fight."
"Simon is speaking rightly," Binnabik said. "I too will let them tie me. You are not having sense if you do otherwise. Simon's white arrow is genuine. It is being the reason they did not kill us, and why they brought us here."
"But how can we—" Sludig began.
"Also," Binnabik cut him off, "what would you plan for doing? Even if these folk here you fought and overcame, and the others who most likely wait beyond, what then? Should you slide downward through the tunnel, you would no doubt be crashing into Kantaka, who waits at the bottom. I think such a startling thing would give you little chance to tell her you were no enemy."
Sludig looked down at the troll for a moment, plainly thinking of the possibilities attendant on being mistaken by a frightened Kantaka. At last he called up a weak smile.
"Again you win, troll." He put his hands forward.
The black cords were cool and scaly like snakeskin, but flexible as oiled leather thongs. Simon found that a couple of loops held his hands as immobile as if they had been caught in an ogre's fist. When the Scythi had finished with the others, the group was led forward once more, through the cloth-covered door and into a dazzling wash of light. It seemed, when Simon tried to remember it later, as though they had stepped through the clouds and into a brilliant, shining land, some nearer neighbor to the sun. After the bleak snows and the featureless tunnels, the difference was like the wild carousel of the ninth day festival after the 8 grey days that preceded. Light and its handmaiden colour was everywhere. The room was a rock chamber less than twice a man's height, but very wide. Tree roots twined graspingly down the walls. In one corner, 30 paces away, a glinting stream of water ran down a grooved stone to arch, splashing, into a pond cupped in a natural basin of stone. The delicate chime of its fall wound in and out of the strange, subtle music that filled the air. Lamps like the ones that lined the stone hallway were everywhere, casting, according to their making, beams of yellow, ivory, pale chalky blue or rose, painting the stone grotto with 100 different hues where they ran against each other. In the center of the floor, not far from the edge of the rippling pool, a fire was animatedly ablaze, the smoke vanishing into a crevice above.
"Elysia, mother of the holy Aiden," Sludic said, awed. "Never know there was a rabbit hole here,"
Grimrick shook his head.
"And they got a palace."
Perhaps a dozen Scythi, all male as far as Simon could tell on brief inspection, were ranged about the chamber. Several of them sat calmly before another pair seated on a high stone. One held a long flute-like instrument, and the other was singing. The music was so strange to Simon that it took him a few moments before he could separate voice from flute, and the continuing melody of the waterfall from either. Still, the exquisite quavering song they played tugged achingly at his heart, even as it lifted the short hairs on the back of his neck. Despite the unfamiliarity, there was something in it that made him want to sink down on the spot, never to move again, while such gentle music lasted. Those not gathered around the musicians were talking quietly, or merely lying on their back staring upward, as if they could gaze out through the solid stone of the hillside and into the night sky beyond. Most turned briefly to survey the captives at the chamber's entrance. But in the manner Simon felt that a man listening to a good story might lift his head to watch a cat walk past. He and his companions, who had been quite unprepared for this, stood gaping. The leader of their guards crossed the room toward the far wall, where two more figures sat facing each other over a table that was a tall, flattened knob of shiny white stone. Both stared intently at something on the tabletop, lit by another of the strange lamps set in a niche in the rock face close by. The warder stopped and stood quietly a short distance away, as though waiting to be recognized. The Scyther, who sat with his back to the companions, was dressed in a beautiful high-collared jacket of leaf green, with pants and high boots of the same shade. His long braided hair was of a red even more fiery than Simon's, and his hands, as he moved something across the tabletop, glittered with rings. Across from him, watching the movements of his hand intently, sat one wrapped in a loose white robe, rucked up around his braceleted forearms, his hair a pale shade of heather or blue. A crow's feather, shiny black, hung down before one ear. Even as Simon watched, the white-gowned Scyther flashed his teeth and spoke to his companion, then reached out to slide some object forward. Simon's stare grew more intense. He blinked. It was the very Scyther man he had rescued from the Cotsman's trap. He was positive. "That's him," he whispered excitedly to Binnebik. "The one whose arrow it is." Even as he spoke, their warder approached the table, and the one Simon recognized looked up. The warder quickly said something, but the white-robed one only flicked a glance over toward the prisoners and waved a dismissive hand, returning his attention to what Simon had at last decided was either some kind of map or gaming board. His red-haired companion never turned, and a moment later their captor came back.
You must wait until Lord Jeriki has finished.
He brought his expressionless gaze to bear on Simon.
Since the arrow is yours, you may go unbound. The others may not.
Simon, only a stone's throw from the one who had made the debt pledge, but still being ignored, was tempted to push forward and confront the white-robed Sither, Jeriki, if that was his name. Binnabik, who felt his tension, bumped him in warning.
If the others must remain tied, then so will I, Simon said at last.
For the first time, he thought he saw something unexpected slide across his captor's face, a look of discomfort.
It is a white arrow, the guard leader said. You should not be prisoned unless it is proven you have come by it through foul means. But I cannot free your companions.
Then I will stay tied, Simon said firmly.
The other stared at him for a moment, then shuttered his eyes in a slow, reptilian blink, reopening them to smile unhappily.
So it must be, he said. I do not like binding a bearer of the Stature army, but I see little choice. On my heart, it will be right or wrong.
Then, strangely, he bobbed his head in an almost respectful manner, fixing his luminous eyes on Simon's.
My mother named me Anne, he said.
Caught off balance, Simon let a long moment pass, until he felt Binnabik's boot grinding on his toe.
Oh, he said, I am... My mother named me Simon. Sioman, actually.
Then, seeing the Sither nod, satisfied, he hurriedly added, And these are my companions, Binnabik of Yikanuk, Hasten and Grimrik of Erkinland, and Sludig of Rimmersgard. Perhaps, Simon thought, since the Sither had seemed to place such importance on the sharing of his name, this forced introduction would help protect his companions. Anne bobbed his head again and glided off, once more taking up a position near the stone table. His fellow guards, after lending surprisingly gentle help to the bound companion so that they could sit down, dispersed around the cavern. Simon and the others talked quietly for a long while, hushed by the strange twining music, more than their situation.
Still, said Sludig at last, after complaining bitterly about the treatment they had received, at least we are alive. Few who encounter demons are so lucky.
You're a top, Simon lad, Hasten laughed. A spinning top. Got the fair folk bowing and scraping. Let's be sure to ask for a bag of gold before we go on our way.
Bowing and scraping?
Simon smirked in unhappy self-mockery. Am I free? Am I unbound? Am I eating supper?
True, Hasten shook his head sadly. A bit'd go down nice, and a jar or so.
I am thinking we will receive nothing until Jeriki sees us,
Binnabik said.
But if he is indeed the person that Simon rescued, we may yet be eating well.
Do you think he's important? Simon asked. Anne called him Lord Jeriki.
If there is not more than one living of that name, Binnabik began,
but was interrupted by Anne's return. He was accompanied by the selfsame Jeriki, who clutched in his hand the white arrow.
Please, Jeriki called two of the other Sithi over, untie them now.
He turned and said something rapid in his flowing tongue. The musical words somehow had the sound of a reproach. Anne accepted Jeriki's admonishment expressionlessly, if such it was, only lowering his eyes. Simon, carefully watching, was certain that minus the effects of hanging in a trap and the bruises and gashes of the Cotsman's attack, this was the same Sither. Jeriki waved a hand, and Anne walked away. Because of his confident movements and the deference that those around him showed, Simon had at first taken him to be older, or at least of an age with the other Sithi. Now, despite the strange timelessness of their golden faces, Simon suddenly felt that the Lord Jariki was, by Scythi standards anyway, still young. As the newly freed prisoners rubbed feeling back into their wrists, Jariki held up the arrow.
"Forgive the wait, and nay, misjudged, because he knows how seriously I take the playing of Shent."
His eyes moved from the companions to the arrow and back again.
"I never thought to meet you again, Seoman," he said with a bird-like chin tilt
and a smile that never quite reached his eyes.
"But a debt is a debt, and the Stadja Army is even more. You have changed since our first meeting. Then you looked more like one of the forest animals than like your human kindred. You seemed lost in many ways."
His gaze burned brightly. "You've changed too," Simon said. A shadow of pain crossed Jariki's angular face.
"3 nights and 2 days I spent hanging in that mortal's trap. Soon I would have died, even if the woodsman had not come. From shame, that is."
His expression changed as if he had shut his hurt beneath a lid.
"Come," he said, "we must give you food. It is unfortunate, but we cannot feed you as well as I would like. We bring little with us to our..."
He gestured around the chamber while searching for the proper word.
"Hunting lodge."
Although he was far more fluent with the Westerling speech than Simon would ever have dreamed at their first meeting, still there was something halting yet precise in his manner that indicated how alien that tongue was to him. "You are here to hunt?" Simon asked as they were led forward to sit before the fire. "What is it you hunt? The hills seem so barren now."
"Ah, but the game we seek is more plentiful than ever,"
Jariki said, walking past them and toward a row of objects draped with a shimmering cloth set along one wall of the cavern. The green-clad, red-haired one stood up from the gaming table, where Jariki's place had been taken by Anne, and spoke in tones both questioning and perhaps angry, all in the Scythi speech.
"Only showing our visitors the fruits of our hunt, Uncle Kendra Jaharo," Jariki said cheerfully.
But again Simon felt something missing from the Scyther's smile. Jariki crouched gracefully beside the row of covered objects, alighting like a seabird. With a flourish, he pulled the shroud away, revealing a row of 6 large, white-haired heads, dead features frozen in expressions of snarling hatred.
"Joko stones,"
Binnabik swore as the others gasped. It took Simon a shocked instant to recognize the leathery, skinned faces for what they were.
"Giants," he said at last. "Hunin!"
"Yes,"
Prince Jariki said, then turned. There was a flash of danger in his voice.
"And you, trespassing mortals, what do you hunt in my father's hills?"
Chapter 38 Songs of the Eldest. Deornoth woke in chill darkness, sweating. The wind hissed and wailed outside, clawing at the shuttered windows like a flight of the lonely dead. His heart leaped as he saw the dark shape looming over him, silhouetted by the embers in the fireplace.
"Captain!" It was one of the men, voice a panicked whisper. "There's someone coming down on the gate! Armed men!" "God's tree!" he cursed, struggling into his boots, shrugging his mail shirt over his head. He snatched up his scabbard and helmet and followed the soldier out. 4 more men were huddled on the top platform of the gatehouse, hunkered down behind the rampart. The wind pushed him staggering, and he quickly dropped into a crouch.
"There, Captain!"
It was the one who had awakened him. "Coming up the road through the town!" He leaned past Deornoth to point.
The moonlight shining through the streaming clouds silvered the shabby thatching of Naglamund Town's huddled roofs. There was indeed movement on the road, a small company of horsemen, perhaps a dozen in number. The men on the gatehouse watched the rider's slow approach. One of the soldiers groaned quietly. Deornoth, too, felt the ache of waiting. It was better when the horns were shrilling and the field was full of shouting.
It is this waiting that has unmanned us all, Deornoth thought. Once we have been bloodied again, our Naglamundas will do proudly.
There must be more a hiding,
one of the soldiers breathed.
What should we do?
Even with the crying of the wind, his voice seemed loud. How could the approaching riders not hear?
Nothing, Deornoth said firmly. Wait.
The waiting seemed to last days. As the horsemen drew nearer, the moon picked out shining spear points in the gleam of helmets. The silent riders reined in before the massive gate and sat as if listening. One of the gate men stood, drawing his bow and sighting on the breast of the leading rider. Even as Deornoth leaped toward him, seeing the straining lines on the guardsman's face, his desperate eye, there came a loud pounding from below. Deornoth caught the bow arm and forced it up. The arrow spat forth and out into the windy darkness over the town.
By the good God, open your door!
A man shouted, and once more a spear butt was thumped against the timbers. It was a Rimmer's man's voice, with an edge almost Deornoth thought of madness.
Are you all asleep? Let us in, I am Isorn, Isgrimnor's son. Escape from the hand of our enemies.
Look, see how the clouds break. Don't you think that is a hopeful sign, Velikis?
As he spoke, Duke Leobardi swung his pointing hand in a broad arc to the cabin's open window, nearly smacking his mailed arm against the head of his sweating squire in the process. The squire ducked, swallowing a silent oath, as he juggled the Duke's greaves, and turned to cuff a young page who had not gotten out of his way fast enough. The page, who had been trying to make himself as unobtrusive as possible in the ship's crowded cabin, renewed his desperate efforts to shrink out of sight entirely.
Perhaps we